Chapter 8. Monday dawned pure and fair, lighting the starboard watch as they worked aft, cleaning the deck with wetted sand, then with holy stones, and then with swabs. The sun heaved up as they neared the capstan, on which West was sitting, his trousers rolled up to keep them from the flowing tide. Sunrise was usually the moment for a certain amount of discreet cheerfulness and ancient witticism, such as, "Here we are again, shipmates," and "Are you happy in your work?" But nothing was to be heard today, apart from the conscientious grating of the stones, the clash of buckets, and a few low warnings. Watch out for sweepings under that old grating, Joe. And this, in spite of the brilliance of the day, the ship's fine, long, easy pace slanting across the swell with a lively rise, and of the favourable easterly breeze that ruffled the sea, bringing an exquisite freshness with it. At 7 bells, hammocks were piped up, and the larboard watch came running on deck in the most exemplary manner, each carrying his tight, exactly lashed cylinder, which the quartermaster stowed in the nettings, numbers uppermost, with the meticulous regularity usual before an admiral's inspection. There was no merriment among the larbolans, either. None at their first appearance in the sunlight, none half an hour later when all hands were piped to breakfast. The old surprises, that's to say those who had sailed with Captain Aubrey in earlier commissions, naturally messed together, even though this entailed the often disagreeable and sometimes dangerous company of awkward Davies. And they listened in silence to his description of the skipper's coming on deck at first light, his good morning to Mr. West, cold enough to freeze his balls off. "Just as well, too," said Wilson, his gazing sternly to windward and his pacing fore and aft in his nightshirt like a lion seeking whom he might devour. "They can do nothing to me," said Place. "I only done what my officer told me to do." "Belayed her, Place, God damn your eyes," says he, "so I belayed. Though I knew it'd bring us by the lee, then let go, follow there, let go, Place, God damn your limbs," calls t'other, "so I let go. It would have been mutiny else. I'm as innocent as a drove of lambs." With some difficulty, Padine said that God had never created a more beautiful morning, nor a more propitious wind. It would soften the heart of Hector or Pontius Pilate himself. Padine was esteemed for his kindness in the sick berth and for his cruel hard times in Botany Bay. He was also thought to have absorbed wisdom from the doctor, and some people took comfort from his words. It was a flimsy sort of comfort, however, and it quite disappeared a little before 6 bells in the forenoon watch, when the officers and midshipmen appeared on the quarterdeck in their uniforms and cocked hats, wearing swords or dirks. Pullings gave orders to rig the grating, and Mr. Adams came hurrying up the companion ladder with the articles of war. As soon as the 6th bell had struck, the boatswain's mates piped all hands to witness punishment, and the frigate's people flocked aft in a confused body from which there arose a sense of collective guilt. "All women below," called Captain Aubrey. Sarah and Emily disappeared, and Pullings at his side said, "Mrs. Oakes is already with the doctor, sir." "Very well. Carry on, Captain Pullings." In her present state, the surprise carried no master at arms, and Pullings himself called the wrongdoers from the throng, stating the crime of each to the captain as he advanced. The first was Wakeman. "Insolence and inattention to duty, sir, if you please." "Have you anything to say for yourself?" asked Jack. "Not guilty, Your Honour, upon my sacred oath," said the butcher. "Have any of his officers anything to say for him?" He waited for a moment. The breeze sang through the rigging. The officers looked into vacancy. "Strip," said Jack, and Wakeman slowly took off his shirt. "Seize him up." The quartermasters tied Wakeman's wrists to the grating, rather above shoulder height, and cries, "Seized up, sir." Adams passed the articles. Jack, followed by the officers and midshipmen, took off his hat. He then read, No person in or belonging to the fleet shall sleep upon his watch or negligently perform the duty imposed on him or forsake his station upon pain of death or such other punishment as the circumstances of his case shall require. 12 strokes. And to the senior boatswain's mate, Voles, do your duty. Voles drew the cat from its red baize bag, phlegmatically took up his stance, and as the ship reached the height of her roll, he laid on the first stroke.
Oh, my God!
Cried Wakeman enormously loud. Mrs. Oakes and Stephen looked up. There is punishment carrying out forward, he said. Some of the people behaved amiss in pulling up the anchor. So Oakes told me. She replied, listening to the successive shrieks with no apparent emotion. How many does the captain usually give? I've never known him give more than a dozen, and rarely so many. Flogging is uncommon in ships under his command. A dozen? Lord, that'd make them stare in New South Wales. There was a horrible parson, a magistrate who only dealt in hundreds. Dr. Redfern hated him. I know it, my dear, so did I. Breathe deep, will you now, and hold it. Very well, that'll do, he said at last. You may put your clothes on again. You say that in just the same tone as dear Dr. Redfern, said Clarissa from under the folds of her blue cotton dress. And emerging, how I adored that man when he told me that I was neither pregnant nor diseased. I might well have been both. I'd been raped often enough. I'm so sorry, so very sorry, said Stephen. For some girls it would have been dreadful. It meant little to me, so long as there were no consequences. Flogging was indeed rare in Jack Aubrey's commands, but this time the ship had been outraged and humiliated, and he punished severely, flogging 7 and stopping grog right and left. Of those who were seized up, none called out except for Wakeman, but none came away unmarked. As each was cast loose, Padin stepped forward, tears streaming down his face, and sponged his shipmates back with vinegar, while Martin swabbed the wheels with lint and passed the man's shirt, a gesture much appreciated. All this was done with the customary man-of-war formality. Charge, response, evidence of character, attenuating circumstances, captain's decision, relevant article, sentence, punishment. And although the later sentences never exceeded 6 strokes, the whole took up a great deal of time, which Stephen and Clarissa, for their part, spent in talking quite placidly about men in general, everyday men in their ordinary life. The last of those to be beaten presented an unusual case. He was James Mason, a boatswain's mate. He was a good seaman, and the officer spoke in his favour. But his offence had been very gross, direct disobedience, and Jack had him brought to the grating. In view of what your officers say, it'll only be 6, he said. Mr. Bulkley, do your duty. It was, of course, the boatswain's duty to flog his mates, but the occasion very rarely arose. Bulkley hadn't been called upon to officiate for years. He'd lost the habit. And taking the cat from Voles, he stood there for a moment, combing its bloody tails through his fingers in a sad state of indecision. He was fond of young James. They got along well together. But the ship's company was watching most attentively, and he mustn't be seen to favour his mate. No, indeed. And his first blow jerked a great gasp out of Mason, rock of fortitude though he was. When he was cast loose, he staggered for a moment, wiped his face, and cast a reproachful look at the boatswain, the embarrassed, confused, and uneasy boatswain. In Stephen's cabin, the conversation had moved on by way of a discussion of pain to the extraordinary difficulty of defining emotions or assigning to them any quantity, quality, volume, or force. Harking back to pain, said Stephen, I recall that when Captain Cook was here, he used to flog the islanders for stealing. "'Twas no use," said he, "one might just as well have flogged the mainmast. And I saw aborigines in New South Wales who utterly disregarded burns, blows, and cruel taunts that I could never have borne. While in the Navy a seaman will generally take his dozen without a murmur. Yet even when all things are considered, youthful resilience, fortitude, pride, habituation, and so on, I wonder that your experience didn't beat the softer, kinder emotions out of you entirely, leaving you sullen, morose, and withdrawn. Why, as for the softer emotions, perhaps I never was very well endowed. I disliked most cats, dogs, and babies. I never cared for dolls or pet rabbits, and sometimes I violently resented being crossed. But I never was sullen then, and I'm not sullen now. Nor am I morose and withdrawn. I think I'm fairly kind, or mean to be fairly kind to people who are kind to me or those who need kindness. And I know I like being liked. I love good company and cheerfulness. Sic erimus cuncti postquam nos auferit orcus, ergo vivamus tum licet esse bene. And I also know that I'm not a monster incapable of affection. She said, laying a hand on Stephen's knee and flushing a little under her tan. Only I cannot connect it with that toying, striving, gasping, what can I call it without being gross, with anything of a carnal nature. They seem to me poles apart.
I'm sure they do.
Sic erimus cuncti. So that was where Mr. Oakes had his couplet yesterday. I wondered. Yes. It was a doggerel version I made when I was putting on my gown, but I was astonished he should remember it. Stephen's only patients that afternoon were the butcher and the boatswain's mate, both of whom, but particularly Mason, needed dressing. Martin had applied the ordinary pads, but he'd had little experience with this kind of wound, the surprise's temper being ordinarily so mild, and a more practised hand was required to wind the cingulum that would enable them to move with something approaching ease. Yet it was clear to the practised hand that he might have a well-populated berth quite soon. Not only was Jack tautening the ship at all points, but on excusing himself for missing dinner, he'd take an extra bite this evening, and with the wind going down like this, they might very well have some fresh fish with their music. He had also thrown out a remark about a flying column. Quite what he meant by that, Stephen hadn't gathered, but basing himself upon the axiom that what goes up must necessarily come down, he anticipated a fine crop of broken limbs, ribs, even skulls. He reflected upon this as he dined in the gunroom. A rather silent gunroom, but one in which the malignants had been largely replaced by anxiety and even by a certain fellow feeling. Martin ate wolfishly, twice desiring Pullings to cut him just a little more of this excellent roast pork. But when at last his empty plate was taken from him before pudding, he told Stephen that he'd seen a remarkable number of boobies towards the northern horizon, and that old Macaulay, who knows these seas, had confirmed him in his notion that this meant great shoals of fish. They might go a-fishing if the evening fell calm.
You medicos may go a-fishing, said Pullings, but I very much doubt whether we do anything but exercise until next Christmas.
Truer words he never spoke. The surprise had by no means passed through the variables, and in the afternoon watch the breeze, which had been boxing the compass for some time, died away almost entirely. Yet it didn't do so until it had brought the ship within a mile or so of the zone where the boobies were fishing, and Stephen's skiff had long since been lowered down. They rowed laboriously out with rods, hand nets, sieves for animalculae, pots and jars, baskets, all of which got in the way, impeding their artless progress and making them even slower, even hotter in the damp, unmoving air. Stephen, who had little sense of shame when nakedness was concerned, and who had so often exposed his entire person that he feared no sunburn, took off his clothes. Martin, more shamefast by far, only unbuttoned his shirt, rolled up his trousers, and suffered. But it was worth their toil. The fishing ground was sharply defined, and as soon as they were over its border and among the boobies, they found that it possessed at least two levels. A turmoil of squids, pursuing pelagic crabs, and the free-swimming larvae of various forms of marine life that neither could identify, though they were fairly confident of the pearl oyster, and two or three fathoms below these, clearly to be seen, particularly under the shade of the boat, swam schools of fishes crossing and recrossing, all of the same mackerel-shaped kind, all flashing as they turned, and all feeding upon host of fry so numerous that they made a globular haze in the clear green water. The boobies preyed on both, either making a slight skimming dive to snatch up a squid just under the surface, or plunging from a height like so many mortar bombs to reach the depth where the fishes cruised. They took no notice whatsoever of the men, sometimes diving so close to the boat that they splashed water into it. And after some time the men, having classified the birds, two species, neither particularly rare, took no notice of the boobies. They scooped up the squids with their hand nets and found that they belonged to at least 11 different kinds, two of which they couldn't name. They sieved great quantities of the squids' food, which they put into well-closed pots, and they caught the fishes. Handsome fellows weighing a couple of pounds, baiting their hooks with pork rind cut in the shape of a minnow. "Paradise must have been very like this," observed Martin, putting another into their basket, and then, "how happy they'll be when we bring back our catch. There's nothing like fresh..." Here he looked towards the ship and his face changed entirely. "Oh," cried he, "she's lost a mast." Certainly she looked horribly lopsided, or rather deformed, but Stephen replied, "Not at all, at all." He reached among his clothes for a little pocket spyglass, pointed, focused, and continued, "Never in life, my dear sir, they're only shifting topmasts." He saw from the great activity in the main top, where topmast shrouds were being set up afresh, that they had begun aft and were working forward in one of the most strenuous exercises known to man. Pullings and Oakes were on the forecastle, Davidge was in the foretop, West was perched in the main topmast crosstrees. They and all the hands under their command were all in a state of extreme activity, and Jack Aubrey, with Reed on one hand and Adams on the other, was timing them with his open watch. "I believe you've not seen it done before," said Stephen, passing the glass. "Will I tell you what they're at, if you'd be so good? First, they unbend the t'gallantsails and send them down and the yard after them. Then they strike the t'gallant mast, a manoeuvre we're all familiar with, a matter of minutes for skilful mariners attentive to their duty, but then they do the same to the great topsail, its mighty yard, and then the very mast itself, a heavy task indeed. This they've evidently done to the mizzenmast and the main. Now they're operating on the foremast, and I perceive from the forms creeping along the bowsprit that they contemplate shifting the jib-boom too, the creatures. Do they look for flaws and change the defective pieces?" "I suppose they do. But I believe the real aim is to make them brisker, to confirm them in their seamanlike activity, and perhaps to strengthen their sense of combined, exactly synchronous effort. Sometimes it's done not from any desire to enforce discipline and instant compliance with orders, but out of a spirit of competition, if not indeed a vainglory in showing away. The old surprise with a crew that had been together a great while, all men of war's men, was extraordinarily good at it. And I remember that once in the West Indies, shifting topmasts at the same moment as the Hussar, considered a crack ship, she did so in 1 hour and 23 minutes, the hands dancing hornpipes on the forecastle before the wretched Hussars had even crossed their main t'gallant yards. See, the topmast is swaying up. It rises, rises. The capstan turns. Higher, higher, secured by a complex system of ropes. High enough. Tom cries, "Launch, ho!" It's fitted and safe.
They fling themselves upon the shrouds and cast off this and that. The brave to gallant mast follows. So it did. And once the frigate looked like a Christian ship again, for the shifting of the jib-boom was neither here nor there to the medicos, they returned to their squids, more active now than ever. "I'm almost certain that over there we have a species quite unknown," said Martin. He leaned out with his long-handled net, but before he'd even dipped it, he started back. "Oh," he said in a shocked voice, "do not move. Don't hang your arm over the side. My image of paradise was only too exact. The evil one is with us too." They peered cautiously over the gunwale, and there, under the frail skiff, they saw the familiar form of a shark. One of the many kinds of carcharias, no doubt, though to tell just which, they would have to look at its teeth. Yet it seemed larger than most, far larger. "Do you suppose it's likely to bump the boat?" asked Martin in a low voice.
"Sherry may well do so by rising suddenly. Or sometimes they're known to take a run and launch themselves bodily into the middle, or athwart ships, as we say, snapping right and left."
"I wonder you can speak with such levity," said Martin, "and you too, a married man." A silence fell, broken from time to time by the splash of a deep-diving booby and the remote shrilling of bosun's calls. A bird dived close at hand, down and down. The shark moved smoothly from under the boat. Its bulk covered the diving form and carried on into the depths, growing steadily dimmer, though still huge, when it vanished. Three or four feathers floated up. "Will he come back, do you imagine?" asked Martin, still gazing down with shaded eyes.
"I do not," said Stephen. "The flesh of the booby is acrid and rank, and I have no doubt he thinks we belong to the same genus, at least."
From over the sea came an urgent piping, and Captain Aubrey's powerful voice urging haste. In rapid succession, all the frigate's boats were lowered down. Their crews leapt into them with a breakneck speed they would have shown if a valuable prize had just heaved up. And lines having been passed, they began towing the ship in the direction of the boobies. By the time the surprise reached them, the sun was already far down the sky. The fish had stopped biting. The squids and their prey had sunk out of sight. And as soon as the boats were hoisted in, the hands were piped to a belated supper with precious little rum served out. "What a comfort it is to have solid heart of oak beneath one's feet," said Martin, as they took their pots, fishes, rods, buckets and specimens out of the skiff. "I had never felt the dreadful fragility of this boat, planking not half an inch thick, so much as when I saw that horrible creature almost touching it. I have never felt more uneasy in my life. As I peered down, it rolled a little and gave me a cold look that I shall not soon forget." Supper was hardly swallowed before the drum beat for quarters. The cabins vanished in the usual clean sweep fore and aft. Stephen hid his specimens, together with a large number of squids, in the quarter gallery and hurried to the sick berth, his action station. The great guns were cast loose, and the drooping officers reported, "All present and sober, if you please." They were soberer still by the time they had performed the great gun exercise, running in the cannon, 500 weight to a man, running the massive object out again as far as possible, laying the tackle falls in neat fakes, pointing the guns in a given direction, going through the motions of firing, running in, going through the motions of worming, sponging and reloading, replacing the tompion, housing and making all fast. A dozen turns apiece, each separately timed by their inflexible captain, and then a full broadside together, all this in dumb show. They were not indulged in a single round of live ammunition, for although the magazines were tolerably full, powder being one of the few things that New South Wales could supply, Jack Aubrey had no intention whatsoever of giving them pleasure. He was profoundly displeased with his officers and men, and with himself for not having detected this spirit of faction earlier.
He was in no mood for indulgence of any kind, and the hands knew it. There was no singing or dancing on the forecastle during what little remained of the sweetest evening. The hands sat about dog-tired until the setting of the watch. They didn't resent the skipper's anger. They knew it was justified. They hoped it wouldn't last. A vain hope. All through the variables, they were kept on the run, manning and arming boats, lowering them down and hoisting them in, until they achieved 25 minutes, 20 seconds for the one, and 19 minutes, 50 seconds for the other. They could also send up lower yards and topmasts and cross to gallant yards in 4 minutes, 4 seconds. And apart from shifting topmasts every now and then, there was always the bending of new sails, painting ship, and a remarkable amount of small arms and cutlass exercise. Throughout this time, Jack kept his severity for the quarterdeck. Once in the cabin, he was as amiable as ever. He played his violin to Stephen's cello with his usual whole-hearted enjoyment. And apart from the deep lines in his weather-beaten face, there was little to show the strain he was under. "Lord Stephen," said he, after a day of particularly wearing exercise, "I cannot tell you what a refuge this cabin is, and what a happiness it is for me to have you to talk to and play music with. Most captains have trouble with their ship's people from time to time. On occasion, it's a continual sullen, covered war. And unless they make cronies of their first lieutenant, as some do, they have to chew over it alone. I don't wonder that so many of them grow strange or bloody-minded, or run melancholy mad, for that matter. Even when they did reach the full northeast trades, there was no relaxation of his manner on deck. He was fairly cordial to Pullings, Oakes and Reed, always civil to Martin, and markedly polite to Clarissa when he saw her. But he remained stern, impersonal, remote, and exigent with the other officers and the foremast jacks. Nor was there much relaxation in their daily and nightly toil, for the trade wind proved more northerly and considerably less steady than he could have wished, and this called for the nicest management of the helm, a continual attention to brace and bowline, and a frequent change of jibs and staysails if the surprise were both to keep her course and run off her 200 sea miles between one noon observation and the next. He spent most of his waking hours on deck with Pullings, and he liked West, Davidge and Oakes to spend much of theirs aloft, supervising the exact carrying out of his orders or even anticipating them. They grew worn and lean. They were haunted by the dread of being found asleep on their watch. And the gunroom dinners were silent less from animosity than extreme fatigue. None of them had ever known a ship driven so hard so long. "My dear," wrote Stephen, "we are now in the realm of the trade wind, and we fly along at an exhilarating pace. But sailing against the wind, or as nearly against it as lies within the abilities of a square-rigged ship, is very unlike sailing before it, very unlike those luxurious days of rolling down to St. Helena when one sits under an awning admiring the sea or reading one's book, and when the mariners are not required to touch the flowing sheet. Now we lean over to a dangerous degree, and the spray, or even solid water, comes sweeping back with uncommon vehemence. Jack comes down soaked. Not that he comes down often, because sailing of this kind requires his presence on deck. It would be much, much easier for all concerned if he would spread fewer sails and keep the wind 1 point free. Yet he means not only to reach Oahu as soon as ever he can, but he also, and above all, wishes to deal with the present situation by recalling all hands to their duty. And he's doing so with a greater authority than I knew he possessed. Whether he will succeed in his purpose, I do not know. He sees the trouble as being caused by the enmity between the officers who are attracted to Mrs. Oakes and these officers being supported by their own men, so that there are rival clans in the ship. But there are complexities that escape him. And now that I have time and to spare, and the cabin to myself, I shall endeavour to set them out as well as I can. The divisions, if I may so call them, amount to at least half a dozen. There are those, the majority, who condemn Clarissa for lying with any member of the quarter-deck at all, apart from her husband, those who condemn her for lying with any officer but their own, those who support Oakes without reserve, they belong for the most part to his division, and they are known as the Oak Apples, those who condemn him for having beaten his wife, those who support their divisional officer, whatever his situation with regard to her, and those who still look upon Clarissa with affectionate esteem. The sailmaker, for example, has recently made her a tarpaulin cloak, in which she now sits by the taffrail. Even if it were right for me to open my mind to Jack, I doubt it would be useful. I do not think I could ever make him understand that for her the sexual act is trivial, of no consequence. Our ordinary salute, the kiss, is held infamous among the Japanese, if bestowed in public. With them, says Pinto, it is as much a deed of darkness, or at least of total privacy, as physical lovemaking is with us. For her, because of the particularity of her bringing up, kiss and coition are much the same in insignificance. Furthermore, she takes not the slightest pleasure in either. If, therefore, through a variety of motives in which good nature and even compassion certainly have a part, as well as a general desire to be liked, she has admitted some men to her bed, she has done so very innocently. If an ill-looking, pitiful fellow would say, a thorn in his foot begged you to take it out, sure you would consent, even if doing so were rather unpleasant than otherwise. To her astonishment, she had found herself loved and hated in various degrees, rather than merely liked by those she obliged, and condemned by many who were in no way concerned. At different times I had tried to explain the violent male desire for exclusive possession, the standard by which a wide variety of partners, if not promiscuity, is laudable in oneself, vile in women. The want of sequence or even common honesty of mind coupled with unshakable conviction. The unreasonable yet very strong and very painful emotions that arise from jealousy, a feeling to which she is almost entirely a stranger, and the very great force of rivalry. I also told her with authority that nothing can be done aboard ship without its being known. I spoke each time at some length, with real concern for her. She listened attentively, and I think she believed me. At any event, she's determined to renounce fornication, though how she will fare I know not. She has lit a fire that will not easily be put out. And although for the moment Jack keeps all hands in such a state of perpetual activity that the members of the gunroom mess can hardly put one foot in front of the other when they come below, these passions, confined as they are in space, may burst out later with a shocking force. He sat there lost in his reflections, until Killick came in and said, as he had so often said before, "What are you sitting in the dark?" He brought a light, a lantern that swung in gimbals, and Stephen returned to his contemplation, holding his pen in the air. "Scribble, scribble, scribble, Dr. Matcham," said Jack. "You're not wet at all, I find," said Stephen. "No," said Jack, "not to put too fine a point on it, I'm quite dry. And was you to put your nose above the combing and look at the dog vane, you would see why. The wind has veered a whole point and the spray goes well away to leeward. In any case, the sea has gone down. Could you do with a cup of coffee and a breadfruit biscuit?" "I could too." "Killick! Killick there!" "Sir," said Killick, still unnaturally meek, though a shade of the familiar shrewishness could now be detected. Indeed, he'd recovered enough assurance to bring them only a meagre plate of the dried breadfruit slices, he being devoted to them himself. The coffee came. And when half had been drunk, Jack said, "Do you remember that I spoke to you about a flying column?" "I remember it well. And I wondered at the time how and where it was to fly." Jack took a sheet from his desk and said, "This is Wainwright's chart of Oahu, and I'm particularly grateful to him for the soundings of the reef off Pabe here in the north and the channel into the harbour. The same for Oahu down in the south. This hatching across the neck of the hourglass, a damn wide neck for an hourglass, I may say, represents the mountains that separate the two lobes. Kalahua's country in the top half, Queen Puolani's in the bottom. Now, my plan is to sail straight into Pabe, preferably in the evening, but that depends on tide and weather, to sail in looking as like a whaler as possible, and to lay the Franklin aboard directly, dealing with her out of hand as we did the Diane at St. Martin's. But time and tide may not serve, and she may have thrown up batteries on either side of the Narrows, using the True Love's guns. I may have to lie off and deal with them first. So it seems to me that if things do not go as smooth as they did at St. Martin's, we should land a body of men here, pointing to a bay half a mile south of the harbour, to make a diversion, to take them from behind while we're battering them from in front. That is my flying column. And what I should like you to do as a medical man is to help me choose the most active, intelligent, and, of course, healthy of the 20 or 30 men we can afford. I do not want any poxed hands, and I know you have the usual crop after Anamooka, or bursten bellies, however brave they may be, nor any ancients above 35. They must be extremely nimble. So please look at the list Tom and I have drawn up and tell me if there is an objection to any of the names from a medical point of view." "Very well," said Stephen. And having run his eyes down the list, he went on, "Tell me, are we far from Oahu?" "About 4 days' sail. I mean to ease off tomorrow and give them a quiet Sunday, then target practice on Monday to air their intellects, and in the evening I may tell them what's afoot."
"I see.
Now, as to your list, I've made a mark against the least medically sound. It's not necessarily discreditable at all."
"Many thanks.
Then, of course, there is the command. But I hesitate to question you about your messmates." Stephen's face closed. He said, "Purely as the ship's surgeon, I should make no exception to any of them."
"I'm happy to hear it."
There was a somewhat embarrassed silence, and to break it, Stephen said, "Had we but world enough and time, you could choose your band in the Irish manner. Did I ever tell you of Finn McCool? The gentleman that was so fond of salmon? Himself. Now, he commanded the forces of the nation, the Fianna, Aaron, and none was accepted into any of the 7 cohorts. I quote from a fallible memory, Jack, but at least I'm sure of my figures. Until he had learned the 12 Irish books of poetry and could say them without book. If the party to be accepted would defend himself with his target and sword from 9 throws of the javelin from 9 of the company, that would stand but 9 ridges from him at distance, and either cut the javelin with his sword or receive them all on his target without bleeding on him, he would be accepted, otherwise not. If the party running through the thickest wood of Ireland were overtaken by any of the 7 cohorts, and they pursuing him with all their might and main, he would not be taken of them in their company. But if he had outrun them all, without loss of any hair of his head, without breaking any old stick under his feet, and he leaping over any tree that he should meet, as high as the top of his head without impediment, and stooping under a tree as low as his knee, and taking a thorn out of his foot, if it should chance to be in it, with his nail, without impediment of his running, all which, if he had done, he would be accepted as one of the company, otherwise not." 12 books, did you say? 12 upon my soul.
And all by heart. Alas, with a Sunday coming between, I doubt it can be accomplished. The Sunday in question was, emphatically, a day of rest, of as much rest as was feasible in a ship at sea. It is true that hammocks were piped up half an hour earlier than usual, and that breakfast was swallowed fast, so that the deck could be brought to a high state of perfection, with what little brass the frigate possessed blazing in the sun and all the ship's pigtails. The surprise, rather old-fashioned in some respects, still had well over 50, some of the most impressive length, untwined, often washed and always plaited afresh by the seaman's tie-mate, while all hands put on the clean clothes washed on Thursday and made themselves fine for divisions. Divisions passed off perfectly well. The wind, though less powerful than it had been for some days, was steady and dead true to its quarter, with never a gust or a flurry. And the captain, though scarcely jovial, could be said to have lost his wickedness. While when church was rigged, it was observed that he had abandoned the articles, leaving the sermon to Mr. Martin. Martin had no gift for preaching. He didn't feel himself qualified to instruct others in moral, still less in spiritual matters. And his few sermons and the surprise, delivered long ago when he sailed as a chaplain rather than as surgeon's assistant, had been ill-received. He now therefore confined himself to reading the works of more able, or at least more confident, men. And as Stephen reached the half-deck on his way to the cabin from the sick berth, where he had said a rosary with Padin and some other papists, he heard Martin's voice. "Let no man say, I could not miss a fortune, for I have studied all my youth. How many men have studied more nights than he hath done hours, and studied themselves blind and mad in the mathematics, and yet wither in beggary in a corner? Let him never add, but I studied in a useful and gainful profession. How many have done so too, and yet never compassed the favour of a judge? And how many that have had all that have struck upon a rock even at full sea and perished there?" And then, some time later, "What a dim vespers of a glorious festival! What a poor half-holiday is Methusalem's 900 years to eternity! What a poor account hath that man that says, 'This land hath been in my name and in my ancestors from the conquest!' What a yesterday is that! Not 600 years! If I could believe the transmigration of souls and think that my soul had been successively in some creature or other since the creation, what a yesterday is that! Not 6,000 years! What a yesterday for the past, what a tomorrow for the future, is any term that can be comprehended in cipher or counters." Jack dined that day, and dined well, off Stephen's fish, last year's lamb, and a thumping great spotted dog. His guests being Stephen himself, of course, Pullings, Martin, and Reed. With the ship running fast and easy, the water racing down her side in a speaking stream, they could not but be happy. A subdued happiness, however, in Pullings and Reed, still oppressed by the shameful exhibition at Alamuka. And after dinner, they moved up to the quarter-deck for their coffee. Mrs. Oakes, who dined a little after 12, had already been there for some time. Her chair installed at the leeward end of the taffrail, and her feet resting on a cheese of wads placed there by William Honey, an admirer still, like the rest of his mess. She was alone, her husband, West, and even Adams being fast asleep, as indeed were almost all hands who were not actually on duty. The main and foretops were filled with seamen asleep on the folded stunsails, their mouths open and their eyes shut, like Dutch boers in a harvest field. And Davidge, the officer of the watch, had taken up his usual position by the weather hanses. Jack led his troop aft and asked her how she did. "Very well indeed, sir, I thank you," she said,
It would be an ungrateful woman that didn't feel amazingly well being carried over the sea in this splendid fashion. Driving fast on a turnpike in a well-hung carriage is charming, but it is nothing in comparison of this. Jack poured her coffee, and they talked about the disadvantages of travel by land. Coaches overturning, horses running away, horses refusing to run at all, crowded inns. That is to say, Jack, Clarissa and Stephen talked. The others stood holding their little delicate cups, looking as easy as they could and simpering from time to time, until at last Martin contributed an account of a very wretched journey across Dartmoor in a gig whose wheels came off as night was falling, a rainstorm beating in from the west, the linchpin lost in a bottomless mire, and the horses audibly weeping. Martin was not one of those few men who can speak naturally when they're in a false position, and Stephen observed that Clarissa was secretly amused, yet she helped him along with polite attention and timely cries of, "Heavens! Dear me! And how very horrid it must have been!" From this, perhaps as an illustration of the greater ease of travel by sea, the conversation passed on to her footrest. "Why is it called a wad of cheese?" she asked. "A cheese of wads, I believe, ma'am," said Jack. "Cheese because it's a cylinder like a tall, thin Stilton, and wads because that's what the cloth is filled with. I dare say you've seen a man load his fowling piece?" Clarissa bowed. "First he puts in his powder, then his shot, and then with his ramrod he thrusts down a wad to hold everything in place until he wishes to fire. That's just what we do with the great guns. Only, of course, the wads are much bigger." Again, Clarissa bent her head by way of agreement, and Stephen had the impression, or rather the certainty, that if she'd spoken, her voice would have been as unnatural as Martin's. "Now that I come to think of it," said Jack, gazing amiably at the eastern horizon, upon which Christmas Island should soon appear if his two chronometers, his last lunars and his noonday observation were correct. "Now that I reflect, I don't believe you've ever seen the operation. You've always been below. We mean to have target practice tomorrow, and if it would amuse you to watch, pray come on deck. You could see everything quite well as you to stand amidships by the barricade, though perhaps you may not like the explosions. I know that elegant females," smiling, "do not always like it when one fires even a fowling piece at anything like close quarters." "Oh, sir," said Clarissa, "I'm not so elegant a female as to mind the report of a gun. And I should very much like to see your target practice tomorrow, but now I think I must go and rouse my husband. He particularly desired me to wake him well before his watch." She rose. They bowed. And as she went down the companion ladder, the lookout at the masthead cried, "Land ho! On deck there, land on the starboard bow! Hello, sort of Long Island!" He added in a subdued voice for the benefit of his friends in the main tops, "with more of them fucking palm trees." Early on Monday morning, with the sun slanting low across the long even swell so that its rounded summits, a furlong apart, were visible, though very soon they would be quite lost in the little fret of superficial waves, Captain Aubrey spread t'gallantsails, and the hands racing aloft very nearly crushed Stephen and Martin as they crouched in the mizzen top, training the glass aft over the rail, gazing back at the land and the cloud of birds over it. "I am persuaded that it is a vast atoll," said Stephen. "Vast, prodigiously extensive. Were we to climb higher still, we might perhaps see across it, or at least make out a segment of the great circle." "I should be sorry to disturb the men at their work," said Martin. Stephen looked up as the hands came fleeting down, the outer men leaping in from the yardarm like so many gibbons, and didn't press the point. He said, "We've been sailing past it almost all night, and though the rim of the lagoon may be no more than a musket shot across at any given point, that still amounts to an enormous surface with, no doubt, a comparably enormous quantity of animals and vegetable life. The palms and the birds we have seen from afar, and some low bushes. But who knows what interesting predators, what wholly unexpected parasites they may have, to say nothing of undescribed forms of mollusk, insect, arachnid. There may even be some antediluvian mammals, a peculiar bat that would confer immortality upon us. But shall we ever see it? No, sir, we shall not. Presently the ship will haul off, heave our wind, and spend hours, hours, I say, bombarding the empty sea, on the pretext of airing the mariners' intellects, and in fact doing nothing but frighten the birds. Yet she will never consider stopping for 5 minutes to let us pick up so much as an annelid. Stephen knew that he'd said all this before. Off the many, many islands and remote uninhabited shores they had passed, irretrievably passed. He knew that he might be being a bore. Yet the tolerant smile on Martin's face, though very slight indeed, vexed him extremely. After dinner, they'd eaten alone, he said to Jack, "At breakfast yesterday, when you were telling me about your first days at sea, I quoted Hobbes. The learned curve that spoke of midshipmen as being nasty, brutish and short. Well, in fact, he was speaking of man's life, unimproved man's life. It was I that borrowed his words and applied them to the young gentleman. Very well applied, too. Certainly. Yet later conscience told me that my words were not only improper, but also inaccurate. I looked out the passage this morning, and of course my conscience was right. Is it ever wrong? And I had omitted the words solitary and poor. Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish and short was what he said. And though poor may have been appropriate..." "Appropriatissimo," said Jack. "The solitude had nothing to do with the overcrowded birth of your childhood. The false quotation was, therefore, one of those flashy, worthless attempts at wit that I so much reprehend in others. Yet the point of all this is not to beat my breast, crying, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, but rather to tell you that on the very same page I found that Hobbes, a learned cove, as you so rightly say, considered glory, after competition and diffidence, mankind's third principal cause of quarrel, so that trifles, as a word, a smile, a different opinion, or any other sign of undervalue, were enough to bring violence about. Nay, destruction. I had read this passage before, of course. It was on the same page, as I said. But its full force had escaped me until today, when just such a trifle..." "Come in," called Jack. "Captain Pulling's compliments and duty, sir," said Reed, "and he believed you wished to know the moment the targets were ready." The targets were ready. Rafts made of empty beef casks and what odd pieces of plank and rail the carpenter could bring himself to part with, each with a square of bunting flying aloft. The gun crews were ready too, and had been ever since the captain's words to Clarissa were reported to the forecastle and confirmed by messages sent to the carpenter, and the disappearance of the gunner and his mates into the forward magazine, where, with infinite precautions, they lit the lantern in the light room and sat next door, filling cartridges, stiff flannel bags made to take the due charge of powder, by the light that came through the double glass windows. Each gun crew naturally wished to wipe the eye of its neighbours, indeed of all other gun crews aboard. But they were all eager to mollify their skipper, partly because it was more agreeable to sail under a captain that didn't flog you and stop your grog, but even more because many were deeply attached to him and were eager to regain his esteem, while all hands freely acknowledged his seamanship and fighting qualities. Throughout the last dog-watch of Sunday, therefore, and in what few moments of leisure the forenoon and afternoon watches of Monday allowed, the captains of the guns and their crews titivated their piece, making sure that all blocks ran free, that all crows, worms, sponges, handspikes and other instruments that ought to be there were there in fact, smoothing their already well-smoothed round shot, gently swabbing the name painted over the gunport, Towser, Nancy Dawson, Spitfire, Revenge. This checking and rechecking was carried out by each member of the crew, by the midshipman in charge of a division of guns, by the officers, and, of course, by Mr. Smith, the gunner himself. Everything was passed in review from the upper deck 12-pounders and the long nines in the forecastle chaseports to the 24-pounder carronades on the quarterdeck. No one, therefore, was either astonished or caught unprepared when, the drum having beaten to quarters and Mrs. Oakes having appeared at the barricade, Captain Aubrey called, "Silence!" in the midst of the expectant hush. A purely formal word followed by, "Cast loose your guns!" And, "Mr. Bulkley, carry on." After this, no more orders were called for. The boatswain and his mates eased the first target over the headrail, paused until it was rather better than a quarter of a mile aft and to leeward, then launched another, and so until there was a string of five going away to the southwest. The Surprise had been sailing close-hauled under topsails and topgallants during us, and after a considering pause, Jack bore up and brought the wind on her larboard quarter. The sail trimmers, aware of his motions, left their guns without a word, clapping on to brace and sheet until she was steady on her new course, when they belayed and returned to the stations like automata, no words having passed. With the wind so far abaft the beam, there was much less noise in the rigging, less from the bow wave, and little indeed from the following sea. The men had mostly stripped to the waist. Those with pigtails had clubbed them. Many had tied black or red handkerchiefs round their heads. They stood or knelt in their set positions. The powder man with his cartridge box directly behind his gun far to larboard. The gun heavers right against the ship's side with handspike or crowbar away from it. The boarders with their cutlasses and pistols. The fireman with his bucket, standing like statues. The matchholder kneeling clear of the murderous recoil. The captain glaring along the barrel. And as the target came in sight, fine on the starboard bow, a quarter of a mile away, murmuring words to his crew for pointing and elevation. And all this time the smell of slow match in the tubs drifted along the deck. "From forward, aft," called Jack as the first target came within range. "Do you hear me there? From forward, aft." The match holders reached behind them, seized the match, and knelt by the captain again, blowing the ashes off its glow. "Starboard a point," said Jack to the helmsman, and then much louder, "From forward aft, fire!" The extreme tension broke as the bowgun's captain whipped the proffered match across to the touch-hole, and the gun went off with a deafening crash, leaping bodily from the deck and instantly racing back between its minders with frightful speed. But even before it was brought up by the breaching, the scream of its trucks and the great twang of the rope was drowned by the crash of its neighbour. And so, down the line, in a prodigious thunderclap that went on and on, the jets of smoke stabbed through and through with orange flame, a roar that was taken up in a different voice by the quarterdeck carronades. The wind drove the smoke away to leeward, and the later shot could be seen raising white fountains in the general boil where the raft had been, or skipping with immense bounds over the sea towards or even beyond it. Already the foremost guns, held in on the recoil, were being wormed, sponged and reloaded, but before they were run out again, one after another with the usual rumbling crash, Jack heard a clapping, thin and remote to his somewhat deafened ears, and turning, he saw Mrs. Oakes' delighted face. Her eyes were dark with emotion, and she cried, "Oh, how splendid! Oh, what glory!" Jack said, "It was just a rippling broadside, not to strain her timbers. They'll start again directly." "How I wish Dr. Maturin were here! Such prodigious—" She couldn't find the word. Directly, in this case, meant 2 full minutes after the first discharge. A leisurely performance compared with the Surprise's 3 accurate broadsides in 3 minutes 8 seconds which she had achieved in the days when she was manned entirely by highly trained men-of-war's men. But now many of her people were privateers, who had always shipped by the lay, having no wages but sharing in the proceeds of the voyage less the expenses. They therefore had a deeply ingrained hatred of waste, and they couldn't be brought to add to the expenses by blazing away with powder at 18 pence a pound as though it were free, paid for by the king. In most cases, Jack had mixed the gun crews to avoid jealousies. But sudden death, for example, was manned entirely by the frigate Sethians, privateers and members of a religious body in Shelmerston, excellent seamen, sober and reliable, but even more unwilling than most to waste a shot, and very deliberate in their aim. Still, by training their guns as far aft as they possibly could, they did manage to send most of their shots close to the remains of the target. "That was rather a ragged ripple, I'm afraid," said Jack to Mrs. Oakes. "I trust we shall do better next time." They did better, much better. 1:40 between broadsides, the first raising the target high on a turmoil of white water, the second scattering it all abroad. "Make fast your guns," cried Jack over the cheering. Clarissa's pipe could be heard as shrill as reeds, and he took the ship across the line of targets to engage the next two with the larboard guns, already cast loose by the second captains. Firing from to leeward meant that the flight and pitch of the shot could be followed more exactly, and when Jack, having given the order, "How's your guns?" turned to Clarissa, not without pride, and asked how she'd liked it, she cried, "Oh, sir, I'm quite hoarse with hallooing and amazed with the sound and the glory. Dear me, I had no notion. What a terrible, splendid thing a battle must be, like the Day of Judgment." And after a pause, "Pray, what do you mean to do with the fifth?" "That, ma'am, is for the bow chasers." He looked affectionately at her face, glowing with candid excitement and enthusiasm. She'd never looked so animated, nor half so handsome, and for a moment he was inclined to invite her to come forward and see the fine work of firing a gun. But he hesitated, put the notion aside as out of place, and walked along the gangway over the happy, sweating gun crew in the waist as they were securing their guns, bousing oar, lashings, taut, and talking in the loud after broadside voice about their wonderful accuracy and speed. "Oh, mark you," said the captain of Spitfire, "we should have been even quicker if some people had been more sudden than dead." His neighbour, the bearded Sethian Slade, captain of the gun called Sudden Death, instantly replied, "And we should have been even more accurate if some other people had been more deadly than sudden." Respect for their captain immediately overhead restrained the Sethians' joy, but they beat Slade on the back and shook both his hands, while even the Spitfire crew laughed and said, "That got you in the balls, Ned." The bow chasers on the forecastle were what the Navy called brass long 9-pounders. They were, in fact, made of bronze rather than brass, but the force of the word was such that the hands polished them assiduously, producing all the shine that bronze was capable of. On the other hand, they were long, and they did take 9-pound balls. They were also as accurate as smooth-bore cannon could well be. They both belonged to Jack. One he'd bought in Sydney, the other he had had time out of mind, and he knew its temper, its kick, its tendency to shoot better from the third ball to the 12th, when it called for a rest to cool. If this were denied, it was apt to leap and break its breeching. Both Jack and Tom Pullings loved to fire a great gun. Each had his own picked crew, and each pointed his own chaser. Each now fired 3 rounds. And as Jack himself had taught Pullings, then a long-legged midshipman in his first command, how to point a gun, their style was very much the same. One shot, though true for line, a little long, the next a trifle short, while Jack's third scattered the barrels and Pullings leapt skipping through the wreckage. With the ship taking the swell abeam, the roll scarcely affected guns firing ahead, and she hardly pitched at all. So with a range of 500 yards rapidly narrowing, this was no outstanding feat of gunnery, but it thoroughly pleased the gunners and delighted the hands. Mrs. Oakes' congratulations couldn't have been kinder. And in the excitement, both West and Davidge ventured, "Give you joy of your shooting, sir." All this had taken a remarkably short time, measured by clock rather than by activity and emotion, and a little before sunset all hands were summoned aft. When they were assembled in their usual unseemly heap, their captain surveyed them with a benevolence that they hadn't seen this many a weary day and night. And in his strong voice he said, "Shipmates, we've warmed our guns and new charged them. No fear of damp powder or charges that have to be drawn, and that is just as well because we may have to use them in a couple of days or so. I'll tell you the position. There is a British ship and her crew captured in Oahu, the island we're heading for, by the natives and their friend, an American privateer, the Franklin, ship-rigged, 22 nine-pounders, French crew. The island is used by some English fur traders on the Nootka Canton run and by certain South Sea whalers, and she may try to snap some more of them up. She nearly had the Daisy, as you heard in Anamooka, so we must put a stop to her capers. When we cut the Diane out of St. Martin's, I was able to tell you just how she lay. This time I cannot do so, although the master of the Daisy gave me a chart of the harbour and the approaches. But I don't think we shall go very far wrong by laying her alongside and boarding her in the smoke." The Surprises, who had been listening with the utmost intensity, nodded their heads and uttered an affirmative growl, interspersed with, "That's right, mate, and board her in the smoke." "But we want no trouble," said Jack. "We do not want any of our people to be knocked on the head if we can avoid it. So since she'll be pleased at the sight of a whaler, English or American, our best plan is to sail in looking as much like one as ever we can. Of course, there may be no sailing in. She may have thrown up batteries each side of the Narrows, and she may smoke what we're at. And we may have to deal with the situation some other way. But, in any case, the first thing to do is to make the ship into a whaler. We turned out into a blue Spanish barque once, as I dare say you remember, and that answered quite well." General laughter and a cry of, "God love us, how he sweated! Now, I know at least a score of you have been in the Greenland or South Seas fishery at one time or another, and I want those hands to choose the three longest-headed, most experienced men among them to help us change the barkie into a whaler. A tired, shabby, down-at-heel, 3 years at sea old whaler, short-handed and peaceful.